So I'm pleased to introduce you today to Catherine, Catherine Clarenbach. Did I say it right? Okay. And she has spoken here before, and I really enjoyed what she had to say last time. She'll be ordained this April by All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C. Wow, how exciting. She's also the creator of The Way of the River, a site where she offers spiritual direction website, and that's listed here in the order of service. Catherine is passionate about spiritual care for those on the front lines of justice work, as well as about the power of myth to deepen and enrich our sense of the sacred. So welcome, and thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So you may have noticed.
I may not be like that. That's terrible.
Don't want to not see you all. you may or may not have noticed. I don't know if you were close enough to see. But blowing in the wind makes me teary. I grew up with that song. I grew up with Bob Dylan and with the Peter, Paul, and Mary 10 Years Together album. when I was coming up was like the thing in my household. And my father was in love with Mary Travers when he was in college at Berkeley. And he used to go down to hear them before anybody knew about them. Every Tuesday night, right? Cheap night. And my family has been huge fans of theirs for many years. And so that actually goes directly into the beginning of my talk today, which is that when I was a young girl, I envied my father's generation. John Buck, my father, went to the University of California at Berkeley, as I said, in the 1960s. He marched with Julian Bond, he met John Lewis, and was part of demonstrations around the country for peace and civil rights. My mother and father both worked for the legalization of abortion. Roe v. Wade was the year I was born. And for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. My father told me, don't be envious. There are always ways to work for justice, he said. And I fear that injustice will rear its hydra-like heads over and over as it always has. Every generation has its work. His mother had worked for labor rights and civil rights in the 1930s. And her mother had marched and agitated for the right to vote. My time would come. It seemed to me for a while that in the realm of human rights and justice in the United States, we had come a long way. Recent events have given the lie to that naive idea in some ways. Allow me to share some things I have learned this week, this month, and this year. This week, I learned that since 2012, over 300 incarcerated men and women, overwhelmingly men of color, have died in Florida prisons and jails. Three cases in particular were clearly due to violence by guards, neglect, and outright torture. This week, I learned that Florida police have been using images of specific black men in their target practice. The woman who discovered this travesty did so because she saw an image of her brother, a former uncharged suspect in a case. The image of his face was riddled with gunshots. This month, I learned that Smithfield Foods, the nation's largest pork producer, has been spraying pigs' fecal matter and poisonous waste from its 1,200-foot diameter pond into nearby communities of people of color. This year, I learned more about the ongoing state-sanctioned violence against unarmed Black and brown women, men, and trans people than I had ever feared to know. This year, I learned about what Dr. Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow, the mass incarceration of Black and brown men, and the terrible conditions in which they live. This is what is blowing in the wind. This is what is blowing in the wind. These are our times, my friends. In The Art of Winning Commitment, Marion Wright Edelman says, a lot of people are waiting for Martin Luther King or Mahatma Gandhi to come back, but they are gone. We are it. It is up to us. It is up to you. And in a poem that is very famous to many UUs and Episcopalians and the other liberal religions who claim her as their saint, Mary Oliver writes, the world offers itself to your imagination. Calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, announcing your place. Announcing your place in the family of things. The world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, announcing your place in the family of things. This world, this time, place, and reality offers itself to your imagination. To the ways you can act, write, speak, keep silent so others can speak, can work in solidarity. The world calls to you, harsh for sure, and exciting as we make progress when we do. And the world announces your place in the family of things, your place. We each have a place, work, words, support, in the family of all life. The question here is not, how can I be Reverend Dr. King, whose holiday we celebrate? The question is not, how can I be Mohandas Gandhi? The question must be, how can I be the best, most engaged version of myself? The question is, how am I engaged in the life of the times which are given to me? How is the world calling me? What is my place? What am I hearing in the wind? Every generation has had, and ongoing generations will have, their most visible issues of justice, peace, and power. Every generation has its opportunity to bring our culture and our world closer to beloved community. No matter our individual ages, these are our times, and they are times in which we are wise to heed the words of Reverend Dr. King. He wrote over and over again about how our work can bring hope, that most needed virtue, into our frightened, overwhelmed, paralyzed hearts. He preached about hope over and over again. He preached about hope being, as he said, hewn out of the mountain of despair. He used those words in speech after speech hope hewn from the mountain of despair. Furthermore, he said in his Nobel Prize speech, "I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men." I am thinking of that image of wounded justice lying in the street. And it brings to mind, as I'm sure it does to some of you, Michael Brown, whose body was left in the street in Ferguson, Missouri for 4 hours. And I am thinking of how his memory can be lifted up for a world made more just, more loving through the tears of those left behind. I am thinking of the bodies of all the Black and Brown people whose lives and deaths are a testament to injustice in this country and its history. Today, I have held up for you images of despair and the possibility of hope. It is my experience that in times of despair, we need to find a way from the paralysis of overwhelming horror, to the action that leads to hope. And I don't know how that is for you, but for me, paralysis comes with guilt. Right? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And I have to do something. But I don't have to be someone I'm not. We each have a part. And it may be small, but I bet it's bigger and more rooted, more powerful, more real than any of us can imagine right now. I'm going to ask us later in this piece, to think of a commitment, a promise we might make to ourselves, witnessed by one another, to do our part when we hear and see and learn what it can be. We must get through this mountain of despair. Despair brings paralysis. And if we are to save ourselves and save the life and people of this earth, we must give up the luxury of despair. One tool for getting on and getting through is ritual. Ritual is a way to look despair in the face, in community, and say, "No, I will not be cowed into inaction." Ritual is a way to say, "Yes, I will do my part to learn how to be in solidarity with communities who need me, communities under siege, here and elsewhere." Ritual is a way to offer our commitment and promise both to the living, the families of those who have died, the people of all genders who walk our streets in fear, and to the memories of the dead. And so, this morning, I'm inviting us into a ritual, not only of remembrance, but of hope and promise. The hope of solidarity and love, and a promise to act for justice in whatever way you are called. I invite us to act in solidarity by affirming a promise to participate in the struggle for liberation of Earth and of her people. I invite us to consider what active, faith-inspired, and faith-led solidarity looks like in this congregation, in our homes, in our neighborhoods, and in our communities. This morning, I invite all of us into ritual, and in that ritual, into reflection upon some very difficult things I will share. Ritual needs our bodies, so I'm going to invite you to use your body as a commitment to a changed world, inspired by those who have been slain and by those who felt justified in taking life. I have some names, a litany. It is not an exhaustive list, and in point of fact, I cut it back because I thought, if this list and the details of these people are so long, if this list is so long, we will stop being able to hear it. We will not be able to process what we're hearing. After each name and situation I read, I ask that someone or more than one someone in this sanctuary raise their hand or lift their body to stand in solidarity and commitment to be a loving participant, a justice participant in our never-ending struggle for liberation and for peace that we cannot yet imagine. And I ask that you remain so, standing or with your hand raised until all the names have been spoken. I also invite you to use your voices in solidarity with Black children, youth, and adults whose lives have ended because of a culture that says over and over that Black lives do not matter. After I speak each name into the silence, we will follow with this refrain: we remember you. We remember you. Let us pray. Spirit of life and of love, spirit that has brought up leaders before us for peace, justice, and love, lead our hearts, lead our minds, lead our spirits and our bodies, lead our voices in this ritual of remembrance and in all the acts that follow. Amen. At 10:22 a.m. on September 15th, 1963, a bomb exploded at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. The explosion killed four Black girl children and severely wounded another. To the surviving sister, Sarah Collins Rudolph, we remember you and offer our solidarity. We think of you with love and offer our commitment to resist and refuse racist violence. 51 years later, I offer these names in holy solidarity. After each name, let us say together, we remember you. And those of you who are so moved, raise your hand or stand. Addie Mae Collins,
we remember you.
Denise McNair,
we remember you.
Carol Robertson,
we remember you.
Cynthia Wesley,
we remember you.
Ayanna Stanley Jones, a black girl child who was shot to death by police as she slept in her grandmother's home. The police were being filmed for a reality show. Ayanna Stanley Jones, we remember you. Eric Garner, a black man and father of six, grandfather of two, was choked to death by a New York police officer during an arrest for selling untaxed cigarettes. Eric Garner, we remember you. Renisha McBride, a 19-year-old black woman who was shot to death while seeking help after a car accident. Renisha, we remember you. Oscar Grant, an unarmed black man who was killed by BART officers by a single shot to the back. The officer in question said he meant to use his taser. Oscar Grant, we remember you. Islan Nettles, a black trans woman who was murdered by a group of men outside a police precinct in Harlem. Ilan, we remember you. Rumaine Brisbane, an unarmed black father of four, was shot to death when a police officer apparently mistook his bottle of pills for a gun. Rumaine, we remember you. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teen who was killed by a vigilante neighbor because he seemed suspicious. Trayvon, we remember you. Rakia Boyd, shot and killed by a Chicago police officer who was responding to a disturbance call. The officer mistook her boyfriend's cell phone for a gun. Rakia, we remember you. Michael Brown, an unarmed black teen who was shot to death by a Ferguson, Missouri police officer. Michael, we remember you. Leandra Ellington, Darren Rainey, and Randall Jordan Aparo all died at the hands of prison personnel in Florida. We remember you. Our rising, our hands, are our commitment to follow where faith and love and justice and peace lead. Faith, love, justice, and peace that remembers that all lives matter, and in a culture that says black lives, bodies, and families do not matter, we insist as people of faith that they do. In gratitude and in trust, amen. Please be seated. It's been a hard few minutes. It's been a hard time. Let us rest in meditation. Let us rest in thoughtfulness. Let us rest held in the witness of one another and the love of this place. Let us be in conversation with one another. And if someone over here is raising their hand and I don't see them, wave to me on this side.
I love how you not only present the challenges, but also the hope. That's always, always good. I think I'm still stuck in the place of figuring out, Tina, you talked about thinking about what you yourself can bring forth. And kind of any thoughts on exploring that further in oneself?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, right, repeating the question. The question was, resources, tell me if I get this right, resources and thoughts about where to look for what can be ours to do as individuals. There's a pretty old resource by Peggy McIntosh called Unpacking the Backpack of White Privilege, that for many of us who identify as white can be helpful, and I don't know whether you do or not, but that can be a very helpful resource for folks, and it's available online, and it's a place to look for what does it mean to me to be white. Like, I have a race, but I didn't know I had a race coming up, right? I didn't know what it meant to have a race. I was just an American. And so that can be a really good resource. Another is to, if you're an internet person, to read the blogs and other essays of people of color who are working on these issues. And do your part, do my part, do our part, to learn as much as we can about what folks are saying, so that, for me at least, you know, I talk a lot, right? I'm up here talking. Sometimes I need to be quiet. Sometimes I need to step back, to make space. But I want to do that in a conscious way that is supporting other leaders. Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay. Yes?
You mentioned envying your dad during the time of activism and describe, you know, what they were doing. They were in the streets, they were, you know, vigiling, protesting, somehow. What do you see as the most effective process or method now of bringing change?
What do I see as the most effective process for bringing change? I like to say that I experience no pressure from this question. But that would be a lie. In my work with people with AIDS in the 1990s, when folks were dying before, and dying, before the cocktails, the antiretroviral cocktails came out, we, in my project, in the AIDS project of Center County, Pennsylvania, talked a lot about how we did work that was legislative, but we relied on ACT UP, the more in-your-face, politically aggressive activist organization, because they made our work easier. We became the reasonable, working within the system people, because they were pushing the envelope. So I really, and I am not hedging when I say this, I really think that it is varied, and each of us is going to be most effective in our own sphere. So while I think, you know, Dr. King said, I'll paraphrase, that, you know, yes, of course, it's about changing hearts, but it's also about legislating. And you can't legislate someone's change of heart, but you can make it illegal for them to lynch me. And that's a good start. And so I think it's important not to, as a whole, really privilege one method over another. I also want to add that I think it is easy to kind of demonize folks who are really out there, but remember too what some of their work can do for people who appear more moderate. Does that help? You think I'm hedging? Who else? Yes.
I was introduced to this thought last night. I was watching a tape of a recent Saturday Night Live, and the skit was, it's hard to recreate it all in 30 seconds, but basically it was, we enjoy our position here, and we are doing well, and who are we? We are white people, and it's time for us to take our final lap, because, and the end of the skit was, in the next 40, by 2050, we will no longer be in charge. 2060 tops. So enjoy it while you got it, and get ready to let go. And a white guy had a world, a little ball of the world. He was handing it to a Mexican, and he said, and then he was kind of teasing him with it, taking it.
Oh, God.
And so 40 years ago is 1975.
Mm-hmm.
So 40 years from now, this conversation may be very different. It won't be about, oh, we're privileged anymore. Thoughts on
that? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I do. Oh, so complicated. We know that minority groups can oppress majority groups. We know that most obviously from South Africa under apartheid, right? So I don't think it's going to be, I mean, comedy has to sort of shrink stuff down and make it a little slice of commentary. So I don't know what I think about that. I also, you should know, my sense of humor is a little delicate. I'm often like, oh God, that's not funny. yeah. But I think there's a lot of work that those who identify as white can do before, you know, before power is wrenched away. And it's, power doesn't usually give up, you know, doesn't usually allow for collaboration and sharing, and I think that's where, for example, our seven principles can really help inform the work that we do if we really believe in them, if we're really going to act on them. So, thanks. Yes, Madeline.
Do you think we are moving toward, rather the question being race against race, economic level against economic level?
What's your question? Sorry, that was a little blunt.
Do you agree with me that, you know, in the future we're going to see opposing sides be
class
and have-nots,
mm-hmm.
and how do we work within that model?
Oh my gosh!
The thing in the New York Times this morning about how the kids in public school are all poverty, and how that's going to affect future and education and who gets the education and who doesn't. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I was just talking to a friend of mine who's also a minister and who works on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, And in her county, there are somewhere between 15 and 20 billionaires, and 70% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch in the public school. So yeah, income inequality is a huge issue globally and in this country. I think anytime you talk about justice or sustainability or peace, you're picking something to talk about. We need to also acknowledge that they're all interrelated, that they're all, that intersectionality is the word that is most commonly used, and that you can't look at one without looking at the other. Yes?
I think the most insidious tool of power is the understanding, the fundamental understanding that fear rules. And my question would be, how do you put that thought in the world in neon signs and big red letters so folks like us and folks who are much less blessed than us actually begin to go, oh, fear. I might have power if I'm not afraid. What would that look like?
I might have power if I'm not afraid. I might have power if I'm not afraid. I might have power if I'm not afraid. Your tears are power. And what is blowing in the wind for you is courage. Yes.
I think it's much easier to be outraged by injustice when it's a little ways away from us. When it's in our own community, it's much harder to stand up in solidarity. And I'd like to just remind people that we've got very real racism going on in our community with our brown population, our Latino population. We don't have a very big black population, but the Latino population is enduring many, many injustices. And that is definitely an area where people can work.
She said that here in this area, while there's not a very large black population, there is a large Latino population that is struggling, and that here in these neighborhoods, working with, working in solidarity and in coalitions with Latino folks could be helpful. And that it's hard, and you also said it's harder sometimes when it's right here.
Oh, sorry. Behind you, so you can't see.
One more question.
Well, I just wanted to let folks know, sort of talking about the demographics of this area. The library is hosting a speaker to talk about the history of black people in Oregon, specifically focusing on why there aren't more black people in Oregon. And that's happening on a Sunday in February. I don't remember the date right offhand, but I hope you'll all come and be part of that conversation. I'm working, so I'll be upstairs, but
it's February 8th.
Please go.
It's on the 8th of February.
So February 8th, there's going to be at the library a program on black people in the state of Oregon and why there aren't more. Yes?
Yeah, my name is Adriana and I'm a Latina, so I very much appreciate that comment. And I work with Latinos in the field of mental health every day.
That's great.
So I really connected to with that comment and also with your statement about thinking about how we can engage in social change, positive social change from our sphere. I really connected with that because when I'm trying to think about ways of contributing to that social change, I kind of get overwhelmed because I have to work every day so many hours.
But you're doing it.
But just rethinking about,
yeah.
But there's always room for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So just rethinking of what we're doing in our place to be more to the point of social justice.
That's wonderful, Adriana. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have time for one more. Yes.
One of the tools that I'm using right now is the consciousness that when I'm hearing negative things, to turn that off and not listen to it, and to seek out the positive, the hopeful messages that build up and help me to stay inspired.
Mm.
I'm looking for.
Mm. He said that one of the practices he's using is turning off negative messages and trying to focus on positive messages that build up and inspire. Is that?
Yes, and it's not to close my ears to the horrible things that are happening, but it's to use that positive tool of inspiration to be powerful and not be afraid.
Mm, thank you. Okay.
Just a question.
Yeah.
You said something about despair, you know, makes it too big to deal with, but you said sort of turn that off. I don't know what words you used. What did you say earlier? Despair.
Well, I think the first thing about despair is that we feel it,
yeah.
And you have to acknowledge that we feel despairing. There's a lot to feel despairing about. I mean, a group of scientists just came out this week saying, yes, life on Earth is threatened.
Surprise.
Death by a thousand cuts. Life on Earth is threatened, yes.
Is threatened.
Yes, okay, thank you. But that's something to despair about. So that's the first thing. But I, and as someone who has struggled with depression, I've had to really think about this. In terms of political despair, it is a luxury many of us have to say, I'm tired. You know, I walk around in my white skin and I can say I'm tired thinking about racism today. And just acknowledging that I'm tired, okay, I'm tired, but I'm gonna look towards taking care of myself and being less tired because I need to keep doing the work. So feel it, but don't stay in it. And look, as he said, look for ways to become inspired. I really should stop talking now. Thank you.
Thank you.